Hello everyone, welcome to New Books in Education. This is Pengfei Zhao from Bloomington, Indiana. Today I'll be talking with Lucinda Karsbecken about a new book she edited, Love in the Time of Ethnography, Essays on Connection as a Focus and Basis for Research. Lucinda Karsbecken is a lecturer in the School of Education at Indiana University Bloomington. The book is published by Lexington Books in 2018. As part of the Anthropology of Well-Being, Individual, Community, and Society series. Love is a long-lasting topic in our society. In fact, just a week ago, many of us celebrated Valentine's Day in the name of love. It was the season of the year that we were reminded how much we were loved by our dearest ones and how important it is to express our love to others. In a very timely manner, Lucinda Karsbecken presented this beautifully curated volume, Love in the Time of Ethnography. In what follows, you will hear us talk about not only the different facets of love, but also the unique affective feelings, expressions, and actions in various cultures, as well as love being the founding methodological principle of qualitative research in general, and ethnography in particular. Hello, Lucy. Welcome to New Book in Education. Thanks for joining us today.
Thank you so much for inviting me.
Sure, my pleasure. First of all, congratulations on publishing this beautiful book.
Thank you.
Before we dive into the conversation about the book, could you briefly introduce yourself?
Sure, yes. I'm Lucinda Karsbecken, or Lucy Karsbecken. I'm a lecturer in inquiry methodology at Indiana University, and my PhD was in anthropology. And at the moment, I teach some classes in qualitative inquiry here, and also some introductory classes to graduate students in all aspects of research, you know, everything from beginning descriptive statistics to participant observation and interviewing. So big range.
So what prompted you to edit this book?
Actually, it began at a conference. It was in about 4 or 5 years ago. I was at a American Anthropological Association conference in, I think it was in Chicago. And I was noticing that one of the papers was, the topic was, I think it was In the Bonds of Love. It was a paper by Ian Skoggard. He's one of the authors in the book. And I thought just how unusual that is to have a paper about love, you know, among all the titles I saw and among all the topics. And I wondered why we don't write more about love. It seems so central to life and also to ethnography, anthropology, or any kind of research. So that was when I first had the idea, was on the way back from that conference.
And the title of the book is very interesting. So why do you want to say a little bit about why you think love matters, particularly in today's world?
Sure. I think there's a lot of different levels in which love matters. I think in some ways it always matters, but there is something in both love and ethnography, something very humanizing. And I think a lot of the discourse in today's world, there's a lot of very quick assumptions about other people, you know, whether they're maybe migrants in a faraway place or people with a different political perspective, a different religious background. And I think it's really important at this time, actually in all times, that to have the sort of the attention and the humanizing that comes both in paying attention to a person with love and respect, kind of as a basic kind of background, and also in doing ethnography and taking the time to write about people in an attentive way. like not make quick assumptions about anybody.
Yeah, so I hear you say about humanizing the world and about how to diminishing the boundaries, how to diminishing the unnecessary bias we have, we hold about the other. So why don't you just go ahead and say a little bit more about your understanding of love? And I noticed that in the essay you wrote for this book, you differ a more broadly defined idea of love from romantic love. Would you like to share with us your understanding of love?
Yes, in this book I take a very broad definition. So what I'm referring to, actually all in the book and across the different chapters, and this is one of the things I like about it, people take all different kind of aspects of love and all different types of love. So there is, you know, love of nature, there is indignant love that Felipe Vargas talks about. But I was, in my introduction at any rate, I was kind of looking for love as a kind of ideal that we refer to implicitly when we write about people. I've been noticing, you know, in critical research, there's a lot about what's wrong, about how research is written, but there's also always this implied ideal, because there couldn't be something wrong unless there was something better. So I'm thinking, you know, what is this something better? We're writing because we care about people being heard and seen and respected and treated as equals. And I kind of take that as an implied ideal in social research. And I translate that, and maybe I'm being, you know, too idealistic, but I translate that as something similar to what used to be what is called agape, Greek philosophy, and has, you know, so many different names in different parts of the world. I believe it's Ren, but I'm probably pronouncing that wrong in China. Fellow feeling, is that right, Chongfei? I'm probably butchering your language. R-E-N. Trying to get at some broader idea of something that connects all people. So that is one meaning of the word love that I think about as a sort of implied ideal for ethnography. What are we really trying to do, and why? Why do we write about people? What kind of world do we want, and why? So when I use the word love, I'm thinking more in terms of something like agape than romantic love. But that's also an aspect of love that comes up in the book as well, more personal, more romantic.
Yeah, exactly. I just feel like there are so many different types of love that have been very beautifully expressed, that have been very beautifully documented in this book. And altogether, it feels like a multi-vocal, that sort of performance or something that really make people feel inspiring, make people feel loving. And I love what you said about this more general, more like broader definition of love. So I think if you can give us an example, that will probably help our audience to understand what you mean better. And the love story between Zulfikar and Sharif you wrote about in the book is so beautiful. So would you like to just very briefly share with us this story here?
Yes, this is interesting. Like I knew that I know both of them. They're both have been, or Zulfikar still is a student here, and Sharifa was a student here. But I knew that they had this romantic relationship that was cross-cultural. And I was really interested in how their families dealt with that, you know. And I think in my mind, before I started doing the interviews with them, I had a sort of Romeo and Juliet idea in the back of my head, you know, like this, here's these two people from different cultures and love breaks down the barriers between their families. But actually, it didn't really turn out to be like that exactly. It was a very long friendship. And there were, one thing that struck me when I started interviewing them too was how amazing their educational journey was, how miraculous it was that both of them had come so far. Both came from very poor backgrounds, very different backgrounds. Zulfikar came from a rural village, and he's part of a religious minority in Turkey called the Alevi. And Sherifa came from a working class background. Her parents both had left school in third grade. So first of all, there was this kind of miracle that both of them had made it so far. And
So their love was not blessed in Turkey, or their love was not blessed by their people in their culture. So are there barriers regarding about the intercultural aspect?
Yes, there were barriers, but they were, I think, broken down more by friendship actually than by romantic love. Because they had been friends, they were friends for such a long time, and they supported each other, partly because they both came from these very poor backgrounds, and they had a lot of struggles in getting into this kind of large elite university and being outsiders. And they also had a lot of struggles just getting through school, getting to be able to take the exams. Zulfikar was sent far away from home into a boarding school. In order to get the kind of education he needed and deserved. And Sherifa also had a lot of struggles. And then when they got to the university, there was this kind of recognition as this other outsider. And there was a lot of support between them and a lot of support between them and their families before they even formed any kind of romantic relationship. Both of them were very eager to learn about other people. They were, I use the term ethical openness because I felt like they were very willing at all stages to learn something new, not only about the world, but also about people who were different from them. So there was this kind of learning on two levels in both their lives. And I felt like that ended up being the story in a way, and the support they gave each other and each other's families was what enabled that kind of bridge to be built between the two cultures. I don't know if I explained that very clearly, but
yeah, I mean, sure you are, and you did, and I think so that really makes me think about the prototype of love you just mentioned, the love, the Romeo and Juliet, that type of love. So what do you think is the difference here? You mentioned you changed your mind. You were struck by the difference. Yeah.
Well, I think it was interesting also because I have learned a lot from Zulfikar about Turkish love stories. This is because in the past I worked with him on Alevi literature a little bit. So, and he told me that it's a little different in a way, that the love story doesn't always, actually Romeo and Juliet was a very sad story, but there are a lot of cross-cultural love stories in Turkey as well. And often they remain unresolved. You know, they don't have a happy ending, and Romeo and Juliet doesn't either. But there's also a kind of the idea of love itself in Turkish literature has a kind of it's a symbol of religious devotion as well as romantic love. So it has that kind of extra element. So there's that difference, but with them. The reason I don't think of it as a Romeo and Juliet story was because I think all these other things were, it wasn't like the power of romantic love or the power of Eros that helped them to cross that border between the cultures. It was more like small acts of friendship and support, like when Sherifa's father was in a terrible accident and Zulfika helped so much, or times when Zulfika was struggling and Sherifa helped him at the university. So there was this kind of mutual help that I felt actually was what, and the way they were with each other's families, very open, very kind. I felt like that was what actually helped break the barrier between the cultures rather than romantic love. And in that way, it was different. In Romeo and Juliet, it was romantic love that, and the tragedy that helped the two warring families to see the error of their ways. But yeah, Sherifa and Zulfika's story was a little different, and still is. There's still a lot of mutual support for each other's families.
Yeah, and you just mentioned the ethical openness. I imagine that also plays a role in their relationship. So that's, yeah.
And that was also something that was an element in both of their family and religious cultures too. So Zulfika says he often thinks about the songs he learned growing up and the messages in the songs of the Alevi and the example of his parents and how kind they were with other people from other religious backgrounds too, how they would always share. So that was always a big example for him. And Sherifa too, she has what she takes from her religion is this desire to be a good person. And she has examples of kindness from her own family too. So like they both had those elements that became more important than the difference between the two religions. I don't know if that answers your question about ethical openness, but I was trying to define this kind of willingness to learn about another person, willingness to maybe put your preconceptions aside and really try to understand that person, put yourself in their shoes, perhaps. Although we can never completely do that, but the willingness to try.
Yes, I mean, you did. And that really makes me think about this very interesting relationship between love and the intercultural relationship. I mean, both on a personal level and probably on a more macroscope level. So as what I have heard from you is, love is deeply cultural. Love is deeply culturally rooted. So each culture, there will be very different ways to express love, express these affective feelings. But also there is this power embedded in love that allow us to transcend the particularity of each culture. So that makes me really wonder, like, if you can talk a little bit more about this seemingly paradoxical phenomena about love. So like, how shall we, for example, locate this transcending potential of love?
Well, that's you expressed all that all of that very, very, very beautifully. I think there are a couple of chapters in the book that try to do that, like Pei Wei Li's chapter where she compares Habermas and Durgen, who I'm probably pronouncing wrong, and Phil Karsbeckin's chapter on metanoia also tries to kind of get at that. I think it requires a lot of attention. I'm throwing out the ideas here, but I think in any cultural context, you need to be able to listen. A researcher needs to be able to listen very attentively to get at the cultural context, to not just kind of go in thinking we know what's going on, but to attend to details, to listen, to try to imagine oneself in different social situations. So on the one hand, you're looking at very particular things, very contextualized things and very local things, and trying to make sense of them. On the other hand, this whole process of making sense, I guess, is the more universal aspect, trying to understand. And also, I think that's what love and ethnography, or love and ethnographic methods, I should say, have in common, or ideally have in common. And I don't know if that answers your question. I feel like your question is so deep that it would be hard to do it justice, to give an answer that did it justice.
I feel like this is a question we the book really set up to explore. And as you said, it's such a profound way to think about love, and the book really shows us all these different aspects and all these different approaches to explore this potential. So I think you are right. So it's probably difficult to generalize it in a short paragraph, also, or a few minutes. Yeah, but this is definitely what the book has been trying very hard to do. That's from my perspective. Mm.
Yes, I feel very, very fortunate, because I feel so many good people wrote in such varied ways about love in the book. So we have like very, very personal stories, like Michael Verdi talking about his grandfather going through the process of dementia, and this very kind of attentive portrait of his grandfather and the whole process of dementia and his own reactions. And then there are also kind of much broader takes on love, like Leslie Sponsell's chapter about love and nature, people's love for landscapes and the natural world. And so anyway, yeah, there's all these different kind of flavors of love, I feel, in the book.
Yeah. So I was going to ask you this question, because like the book is pretty much a collective effort, and I regret that I was not able to invite other contributors to our program. So I was going to ask if you could introduce briefly their work in this volume.
Okay, I'll do this very briefly, because there's a lot of people involved in the book. So I guess I'll just go through, and I'll go through it kind of chapter by chapter. There's Leslie Sponsell talking about love and nature, and he uses these words, biophilia, which means love of nature, topophilia, which means love of landscape, and then solostalgia, which is a kind of sadness, like a nostalgia for parts of the natural world that no longer exist, that have been destroyed. So he explores these three ideas in his chapter about the relationship between humans and landscapes, and he has examples from his own life as well. So that's how the book begins. And then my chapter on Zulfikar and Sharifa, and then Felipe Vargas. And what I really wanted to do in this book was have people who were activists or were involved in service, as well as, you know, as well as academia. So Felipe Vargas was very much involved in the Dreamer movement, like long before, for years and years. And in fact, he was a hunger striker. He went on a 40-day hunger strike on behalf of the Dreamers at the time when President Obama was in power. And so his chapter is about the love that kind of keeps those movements going, the love that where people feel solidarity with the other people who are migrants, and how that kind of gives them that kind of indignant energy that keeps them going and struggling as they make movements. And then Ian Skolgard is writing about Chinese missionaries, American missionaries in China, and he did what he calls an archaeology of affect, where he's going through these archives of letters and kind of pulling out the feelings, the sentiments there, because, as he says, love is, it's not just something peripheral. It's what he calls the true history of the world is the history of feelings. And he kind of pulls this out all the way through and shows the things that got in the way of a real dialogue also between the Americans and the Chinese, because the Chinese were sort of positioned in these roles as poor people or sick people who needed help. And he's looking at the need for equality to make a real dialogue between them. Then we have Michael Verdi's chapter about his grandfather and dementia. And Michael Verdi is also quite an inspiring activist. He formed an organization called Memory Bridge to include people with dementia into the community to sort of stop the social isolation of people with dementia. So that's inspiring to know about too. And then Jana Clark and Barbara Dennis write a lovely chapter called We're All Ships Coming Home to Themselves, where they combine poetry, text from other authors, and talk about their own lives kind of moving into queer identity and, you know, how this happened through personal experiences and through reading. And this is a very poetically expressed chapter. And there are also people who've been very involved in activism. And Barbara Dennis works with prison youth here in Indiana. Then Francis Trix talked about Muslim Teke. It's like a Sufi Muslim community that she's been involved with for years and years and years, decades. And I love, she kind of pulled out all the examples of service in that community, very, very earthy things, you know, like shaving the religious leader's head or polishing the floor, these kind of very detailed, personal, practical acts of love. She's also been involved with migrants around the world and in service for migrants in Europe, and she's been writing lately about the positive things that can happen. We hear the negative stories, and she kind of decided to collect the stories of where there were actually acts of communication and care between migrants and the host countries in Europe. Then we have Rochelle Winkle-Wagner, who's like a very well-respected scholar, and how love was such a core part of the research she's been doing for years and years among Black women, talking about love as a sort of basic principle of her research. And she uses the term care in action, which comes from Barbara Dennis, where love is not just a feeling, it's expressed, you know, in things like partly in the way she does research and tries to listen, but also in practical ways, how, when she worked with focus groups, how she would help students with their graduate work and other kind of more practical things. And then Pei-Wei Li writes a very scholarly and beautiful chapter on kind of looking at intersubjectivity in Jürgen Habermas's work. And she relates this to Zen Buddhism, she has a lot of experience with. And then she shows this kind of playing out in their lives and interviews with four spiritual practitioners that she worked with doing her PhD research. Yeah, so it's a very scholarly and beautiful chapter. And then finally, Adam Henze is the poet laureate of the Indy 500, and he's a slam poet. He's also a student here at IU, so he wrote a beautiful poem about one of his students when he was a school teacher who was in jail. And it was a very humanizing poem. And I really wanted to get that into the book. I wanted the book to include poetry as well as other kinds of writing. I wanted the book to include writing that moves, you know, writing that actually evokes some kind of emotional response in the reader. So that was why I really wanted to include Adam's poem, but it seemed like it was difficult to do that because there's a sort of convention in academic publishing where it's very rare that poetry is included on its own. So it ended up that Phil, my husband, wrote a chapter to go with the poem so that we could include the poem in the book. And Phil was so moved by the poem that that actually was quite an inspiring thing for him to do. So he wrote his chapter on metanoia, which is the experience of being moved or stopped by the recognition of otherness in another person, like finding that our words can't really capture that person, that we don't have words maybe at certain times, and that this is a process of change that happens in recognizing the other. And in this case, recognizing the other through a poem, and it's sort of aspects of another person that a poem can catch, but more academic writing can't always catch. So anyway, that's the last chapter of the book.
I think it will be interesting to talk a little bit more about how the book is organized. Because what you just said about the challenge you have to include poetry in this volume is very interesting. Because as you said, it's not a very conventional thing to include poetry in an ethnography or in a scholarly book, so to speak. Right. So, but in this book, you have intentionally include more than one poems in the last chapter, right? Yeah,
because Barbara Dennis also includes some poetry and describing a very personal, very painful experience in her life of an assault that she experienced when she was very young.
So what I was thinking was maybe you can talk about maybe on the more macro level, it's about how you organize the different chapters. And within each chapter, maybe you can also talk a little bit about how to include the different genres, different voices.
Well, I think that's a good question, because I do think style is important, because that relates back to that humanizing quality that I think could be a really important power that ethnographic methods have. And I know I use the word ethnography maybe in a broader sense than just looking at a culture, because I think the book uses ethnographic methods rather than ethnography. But a part of that is the ability to write in such a way that the reader is moved and the reader is able to take the position of the person that they read about to some extent, although we never completely do that. And I think that also one of the messages of this book and the messages of poetry is that you never fully understand another person. So we're always trying. It's not necessarily possible to express that in a linear way. And I think the humility of recognizing that we can't really capture another person in words is an important aspect of ethnographic writing and ethnographic methods. And I think that's incredibly important when there are so many voices that are left out. And it's often when we hear the stories that they're brought into the sort of public, the public finally gets it. We hear a story maybe about Eric Garner saying, "I can't breathe." And that moves people where they might have heard the statistics and they might have heard a more linear account of what's happening to young black men in the justice system. But to hear the story sometimes, and especially if the story is expressed in a way that is humble, kind of shows the things that are never quite captured.
So that makes me wonder, like, how you worked with your contributors. You have many contributors and they all have their own, of course you share a common ground, but they all have their own approach and their own empirical topic. So how do you work with them?
Well, I was very lucky because I think all of them were very good writers. All of them are, I should say, very good writers, inspiring people. And I was really honored, to have them in the book. And I really had to do very little in terms of editing other than set the word limit and do a little proofing. So in that way, I was extremely fortunate, I think, that it was they made it so easy. They were such good scholars and had beautiful stories to tell also.
And you also you group them into different groups, like the first section, you include several chapters, and then you have a different section. So how many groups do you have altogether?
I think I was trying to get at, it was really hard to think about how to group these chapters, actually, because I did it and redid it so many different ways. But I think there's kind of three basic purposes of the book. One is to look at love, to look at different types of love, different varieties of it, flavors of it, kind of, different ways it's defined. So Leslie Sponsel had these very interesting ways of defining love, for example. So that was one thing, looking at love. Then another way was kind of another aspect of the book is looking through love. And I think that's what happened. And that's what the topic of Winkle Wagner and Pei Wei Li and Phil Karsbecken's chapters, more like love as a part of research, love as the thing that gives research its validity and also sort of shows its limits. And then Cells on Others, it was about maybe more about relationships with oneself, with others. Anyway, it was difficult to do. It was difficult to think of three categories like that, or four categories, or how to organize the chapters. So that was the best I could do.
Yeah. So I just want to spend a little bit more time talking about the methodological approaches that the book delineates using the keyword love. So as they there is a one chapter talking about love in action, and I think that really conveys the essential part of taking love as the methodological approach in research practice. So would you like to say more, a little bit more about that?
Love in action, did you say?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Oh, yeah. So you're talking about Rochelle Winkle Wagner's chapter. I think that she expresses that so well in her discussion of, you know, how she bridges the gap as a white woman doing research with Black and African-American women. And yeah, so she says, how can love not be included in her research practice? Because she feels like she has to engage with them on such a deep level to be given that trust, to hear their stories.
Yeah, and love is and she delineates a way to do research, and moving that away from objectivity, value neutral, that type of research of maybe I should say conventional research.
And that is a good term to bring up, I think, because it's actually impossible to do value-free research. We have this sort of model from based in research on the physical world, where you can more or less kind of define objects and figure out how there's a cause-effect relationship between them, although never completely, because we are defining them always. We're not just dealing with a mass of sense impressions. We categorize them and define them and prioritize certain ones, for example, the ones that can be measured. In the social world, it's even more, I mean, the impossibility of value-neutral research is even more clear, as we kind of define, we categorize the world according to the social categories we've grown up with. And even the possibility of communication requires position taking. Pei Wei Li writes very nicely about intersubjectivity and position taking. And there's always a sort of, even if we're on our own, there's this generalized other to which we refer in our minds. And so value-free research is not possible. So the best thing I think that we can do is to be explicit as possible about what values we are drawing on, and as open as possible to learn like something different from another person.
Well, we have taken so much time from you today, Lucy. Before we wrap up our conversation, would you like to let us know what is your next project?
Yeah, at the moment I am writing on an ethnographic evaluation of a training program for caregivers And that is was set up by Memory Bridge, which is the organization that one of the authors in the book, Michael Verity, set up. So I've been doing interviews with caregivers before and after they go through this training program. And it's a very different kind of perspective on dementia. It's not like, oh, this is a disease we have to cure. It's like, how do we bring elders with cognitive disabilities? How do we bring them into the community? How do we build bridges? So anyway, it's quite inspiring to talk to all these caregivers, and it's quite a large project. So, but I hope it's the evaluation will be out, I hope, by the end of April, and then maybe I'll make that into a book, take some of the stories.
That sounds a very interesting and novel approach to the caregiving. And I know it's very challenging to take care of the elders with dementia. And so we look forward to reading your new book then. And we look forward to it to be out as soon as possible and talking with you again in New Book in Education.
Thank you. Thank you, Pompey. Thank you for your wonderful questions.